Major Hun, Reel 41, you were saying that you were advancing swiftly and going through a number of Italian towns.
I think it amazed everybody that we were going up along so fast. We went through Spoleto, Massimatano, Montefalco and Bagagna, and by midday we were coming along towards Foligno, which is our next objective.
Roughly how, you say you were advancing fast, what sort of daily rate were you?
Daily rate?
Yes, have you any idea, a recollection of
the
daily rate of advance?
Well, we got from, we started off at 3:45 in the morning, and we got through all those places before noon, and we were almost to Foligno, which was quite, if you look at the map, it's quite a long, long way. And of course, Foligno was an important town just not far from Assisi. And of course, the objective there was the bridge, which to the north of the town. And so we were going like racehorses. And the scout car, again, in this area, were being sent out on the side roads. Just to make sure we were safe.
Clearing the flanks.
That's right. Otherwise, we could have been cut off. Mm. But that was being done. And
sometimes, by going up onto a flank, especially if you're going up a mountain, you can get good observation forward.
Well, you couldn't really.
You couldn't?
No, no. It was sort of closed in. It wasn't sort of. Because the area was very close country.
Oh.
And so there was no. It was only a matter of security to make sure that your flanks were clear, whether you sent out the scout cars to the leads, while the main heavier vehicles went up
the main road. Was this close because of the shape of the ground or because of the vegetation? Or both?
Well, both, I think. Shape of the ground, because you've got forests and so by just after lunchtime, Lieutenant Whale was commanding 4-2, and Sergeant Catlin was his troop sergeant, and they reached Foligno, and the bridge was being held by German troops, and in fact it was mined ready for blowing, and I think the enemy were rather surprised that with the speed of bombs that they that we got there so quickly. They really didn't appreciate that we were there, or thought of anyway. And it was either prepared or just sort of almost completed. And infantry were dotted around in place to defend it. So there was a bit of a battle there with Fortu and the enemy. And Chutu later came up to help them out. But the infantry suffered a lot of casualties there, you know, sort of 10 or a dozen. And the rest of them surrendered.
This is the German infantry.
German. Mm. And so it was quite a thing for Fortune to have got there and caught them on the hop.
Did they manage to take the bridge intact?
They took the bridge intact, which was a tremendous help. See, because that led across to Assisi, which was just up, not far away anyway.
It sounds as though the troop managed to catch them before they'd actually completed the preparations to blow.
So their engineers and infantry
protecting them.
Yeah, some people said they were paratroopers, but there was no sort of proof of that. We didn't confirm it anyway.
Did you see any of these chaps who had been captured by?
I didn't see them. No, I don't know why. We should have done. Of course, we at the time then we were then within a mile of the bridge, and of course we were all, we, the whole squadron was coming up like racehorses anyway. And two troop of course came up to help these, so I think probably two troop might as well got all the prisoners and got them back somehow.
Do you have any idea of how many of the enemy there were altogether on this bridge?
I should say somewhere around about 15 to 20. As I say, a number of them were killed on the bridge, but they couldn't, I don't think they could realise that.
Couldn't believe it.
They couldn't, no. Mm-hmm. So it was a great time. And of course, with all the shooting and whatnot, just after it sort of subsided, all the civilians came out from Foligno, you know, bought flowers and bottles of wine and wanted. And of course, we were stopped on the side of the road just inside the town, and they brought all this stuff out because we accepted certain things, you know, but you couldn't drink too much wine, and we had a battle to go on for as well, but they were great. But then a sniper started shooting into us, you see, and that was coming from, as we went into the town, there was a school over on the left, and the river, which we'd come along. And so we had to get everybody, you know, to clear off and try to sort out where the sniper was. And so that stopped us from celebrating too much.
Did you manage to catch him?
I don't think so, no. Mm. No, we just fired into the area where he was. You know, we thought he was in the school. So we sent a few shots in there.
Did that stop it?
It stopped it, yeah.
So he was suppressed then?
Yeah, but you couldn't go over looking for him. Because, as I say, our main thing was to push on, not to deal with the odd man.
Earlier on in the desert, you were saying that, you know, gradually the composition of your force had been built up, so that you'd had a half track with your own infantry and sappers in it to give you immediate support. Did they get involved in this fight at the bridge?
No, they came up, but I think the fight was finished by the time they got up there. I think they would then dealt with making sure of the explosives.
Yeah,
and things like that. They were all up close enough, and there was Sergeant Jordan who was in charge of our particular scout camp, and they would come up. And also, we also had sufficient men to form a little infantry platoon.
Yeah,
you see, which they could well have been sent off to do have a look so they could find this sniper. Although, I don't know if they did or not.
Presumably, I mean, they would be useful for patrolling the town to, to make sure it was clear before you moved.
Well, no, I don't think they're in that strength. You know, you couldn't afford to sort of send them off into a town with, eight men. I think we were better off going through it with armoured cars. And I think by then we sort of understood that the enemy wouldn't leave anything behind, only a suicide squad, and I don't think they were into that particularly. And of course, not only were we going, we had 4th Indian Div coming up, which would be pretty hot on our tails.
So they were following you.
They were coming up, you see, and although we got there first and through, but in probably within half an hour or so, their forward elements would be coming up in for infantry with their half tracks and various things. So it wasn't as though, you know, there was a lot of time.
Well, anyway, 4th Indian Div would easily be able to find the manpower sweep the town.
They would be coming up and any mopping up. They would be there to do it. We were the main thing. We wanted to keep in contact with the enemy.
Did you have any casualties during this fight for the bridge at Foligno?
No, nobody was. We got away with it, as I say, surprise more than anything. And But they still started shelling the town. Lots of shells were dropping in Foligno as we were there. And they dropped in the area of the bridge, so they knew we were on it all around it. So we lost one thing, a scout car, and that went up on a mine. But there were no casualties, and we were.
Was that in the town or
on just on the outskirts?
On going beyond it or coming up to it?
Sort of more or less in the town.
Oh, in the town.
On the sort of on the outskirts of town. Because we avoided. We were more concerned in getting onto the roads out of the town, not necessarily going into the town centre. That didn't interest us at all. We wanted to get in. But we did stay in the railway station, the station yard. And by then, all the trucks and the place was ablaze. And that was an awful night. We stayed in the station yard, and all the trucks were about 300 or 400 yards, less than that, 200 yards away, were blazing. And we were in the sort of light of the flames, but we sort of stayed there overnight.
Was this fire due to enemy shelling? Was this?
I think they might well have been set alight to start with.
Before the enemy withdrew.
That's right. They got worse as the time went on, and then they kept shelling, so again, that would probably might have hit. Or oil tank or something. Mm. I know all through the night it was pretty awful. There was no sleep or anything like that. Mm. And the flames were going up. So it wasn't an enjoyable. It was in the yard. I think it was a good yard. So there'd be a lot of stuff burning there. I'd say there was sort of shelling, the odd half a dozen would drop, and then a waste to, and then a bit more. And I think they were shells, I don't think they were mortar bombs. Mm. So when daylight came, we were all pretty relieved. So we carried on the advance, and and on the mountain track near Foligno, going out, Lieutenant Roddick was killed, and his driver, called Longmanoid, was injured. But his armoured column turned over on the mountain track, and so Lieutenant Roddick was killed in the accident.
This has nothing to do with the enemy?
No, he was on his way. One of these tracks going off
to the side.
With his name, a scout car.
Yeah.
And obviously a narrow track, and he probably went over the side, which was unfortunate, only the younger second lieutenant. And 6th Troop was Lieutenant Coates. He'd reached the CC and was advancing from CC up towards Gubbio. And they ran into an ambush, and his armour car, two armour cars were destroyed, the two Dana were destroyed.
Do you know what it was that got them? Was it panning?
Bazooka.
Bazookas.
Yeah. Because that was that type of road, where they could lay on. And Lieutenant Coates was wounded, and he was taken prisoner. His driver, a Trooper Nesmith, was killed instantly, so they must have hit that.
Hit the driver's compartment then?
First, I think, yeah. And his gunner, Lance Corporal Pratt, was wounded. But he escaped and got back to the squadron. Mm. And the other crew, the other vehicle, escaped unhurt. But Pratt was wounded. In fact, I took him back to the CCS straight away. Now, he had a brother in the same squadron, and they want to be in the same armoured car, which is a thing, which is not a good thing to do, because if one was killed, or they could both be killed. So the policy was that they, although they were in the same squadron, they wouldn't be in the same troop. Mm. And in fact, his brother survived as well.
What did he say had happened? Do you remember what he said about the ambush?
It's just a matter of that they were well prepared ambush, you know, and they just drove into it, and the bazookas opened up, and the chaps who got away sort of said the same thing. You know, there's nothing much they could do. Fortunately, they didn't have a lot of infantry around there that could prevent them from escaping. I suppose they were quite pleased they'd knocked out the armoured cars and sat back and waited. But the quick reaction of the crews, you know, well, bail out. And
So the crew of the second car was the lieutenant was dropped was in the first car.
Right.
He was in the leading car.
Leading.
And the second car, how far behind would that be?
Depending on the road, but it could be anything up to 100 yards. Might have been even less, 50. But everything was according to what the ground was like. So you could be in a position to support the car that was in front.
So the people in the second car would have had a bit of a start, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And Lance Corporal Pratt, what was his wound? Do you remember?
Shrapnel in his arm. So yeah, it didn't stop him from running.
Jumping out and running back.
I think had it been in the leg or something, it might have. He might have been taken from. I don't know what wounds. Lieutenant Coldstock, probably it could well have been shrapnel again, because if an explosive hit the armour car, all the inside bolts and all that used to shatter off and fly round. So he could have been wounded in the leg, which stopped him from running
getting away. Which side of the car would the driver be? Would he be left hand side or right hand side?
Slightly right hand.
And what about the position of the two men in the turret?
The commander would be immediately below, behind the gunner, behind the driver, probably about a foot, 2 foot away.
Yes.
And the driver would be down, the commander would be about 2 foot down, and he'd head out of the turret, and the gunner would be immediately on his left, so almost touching.
And But he'd be down, wouldn't he, inside the turret, looking through the side.
He'd be sitting on his seat.
Yes.
The gunner.
Yes.
Yes, he'd be sitting, looking. So it looks as though that could have been killed the driver, and the shrapnel comes through. And I wouldn't be surprised if Lieutenant Coates was wounded in the legs.
So it sounds like Lieutenant Coates probably shielded the gunner from the shrapnel, yes, because if the bazooka came in on the driver's side, that would be the same side as the lieutenant, and so the stuff would fly around,
and could have got the worst,
he'd be in the way. You don't remember which arm Corporal Pratt was?
No, I can't. But also too, it depends on a lot where the turret was. If the turret was forward, with the gun forward, you know, or it could have been slightly left, where the driver could have gone out and left him and could have got the worst of it. And Paul was practically shielded by
the lieutenant. What happened to Corporal Pratt? Did he come back to you?
No, he was sent back.
He was.
Bad enough to not come back anyway.
You don't remember him coming back to the regiment later on?
No. Normally, if they're wounded like that, and by then, within 6 months, the war was over, near enough. And so he would go out altogether. And he was a conscript anyway, so he would be coming towards
You mentioned that this is 1944, the Second Front had opened. What impression did that make on you, news of the landings in Normandy?
Not a tremendous amount, really. You know, we weren't particularly interested. You know, we had our own little, we were still 8th Army, mm-hmm. and we reckoned we'd done our fair share of it, but all the glory was going to the Second Front, no, really. And our general by then, was about then, was Dick McCreary, who was an old Trump Lancer, of course. No, but we didn't seem to take a lot of interest in the Second Front at all. I think we were too involved in our own.
Did you suspect that the war was winding down and was likely to end when you heard about Second Front?
Because having got across to Italy, and we were going, and we thought, well, our next base would be Austria. You know, we knew that, and we knew the Russians were doing well. Mm. So it was, we knew the end was in sight.
Yes.
As opposed to when we were on the desert when we...
So you had expectations that the war was going to come to an end. Did you have any precise ideas about how long you thought it was likely to take, or
no.
anything of that sort?
No. But also, too, in the back of our minds, too, was having finished this one, when it finished, we still had Japan to think about. And I was certain that I would finish up going to Japan or the Far East. Because I had a brother who was a prisoner there, so I had an interest in wanting to go there.
Did you have any news of him while you were in Italy?
Once. When I was, I think, on the desert, when I heard he was a prisoner, I wrote a long, long letter to him. And I got a letter back from the Red Cross to say that really you should only send 10 words or something like that. But they would send it on, they'd send it, hoping that he might get it. Mm. And it wasn't until after the war that I found that he had got it. He had it and he kept it with him. He said it was tremendous to have it throughout the war. So it was a good thing. That's the only communication I had or made during the war.
Did you hear anything back from him?
No.
Where was he captured?
At Singapore. Oh. He was with the 4th Norfolk Regiment as a TA. Mm. And of course, everybody in the 4th Norfolk TA thing were from my hometown, so I knew most of them. You know, as a boy, I went to school with them, and I lost quite a lot of friends with them. He managed to survive.
Did you get regular bulletins of news from the Far East, you know, as another front?
No, we heard nothing apart from disasters, like the sinking of the battleships and that sort of thing, but we had no real news about it.
Earlier on, you said that at some stage you got to the point where you were communicating more or less directly with friendly aircraft. Mm-hmm. Do you recollect when that started?
I think it was up around the area of the Ronco, mm-hmm. which we'll come on to in just a short time.
Right.
I think that was when we first started having where you could direct aircraft down to a target.
I mean, how was that done? Did you have a radio that could speak to the pilots overhead?
Radio a connection with a man on the ground who had, whether he was army, attached to the RAF, and they had it by that system.
So it was an indirect link.
Yeah. And it wouldn't be us directing them. Mm. We would say, right, the enemy at a particular place, and that, and then they would direct the aircraft to it, because they had lots flying around, I think. Sort of like waiting to be called up.
Did you ever nominate targets yourself for them?
Not myself, no.
No. Yeah. Do you have any idea of how long it actually took to call up the aircraft?
Oh, I think the system was very good. I think you could do it in sort of 20 minutes, half an hour. But as I say, that was done mainly either the troop leader.
Yes.
Who was, you know, there, could see the actual...
So the troop leader would be able to radio back to the forward air controller or whatever
was,
and then within 20 minutes of that, the aircraft would be overhead.
Of course, I think there were lots of aircraft in the air, sort of waiting, probably not so much with us, but with infantry radios and things like that. Where were we? We'd come through Foligno, hadn't we?
You'd come through Foligno, and you'd had a bad night at the railway station.
That's right, yeah. And on the 18th, this would be June, I think, wouldn't it?
18th of June, 44.
Yeah. All troops were out on patrol by dawn, and that dawn was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And you know, very. And I went off with three troops, and we came along to a bridge that had been destroyed, and that was on our main line of advance. So we managed to get all the civilians volunteered their help, and we made the bridge so we could get across it. It wasn't sort of repairing the bridge, but filling in the ground and getting it so that we could drive over. And it was, I remember the time, it was heavy, heavy rain. But all the civilians were very good. They came and lent a hand, and gradually we got it filled, and so we could cross it.
Well, what sort of thing was it over? Was it over a
sort of not a river, but of not a very deep sort of little ravine sort of thing. Yeah. But it's deep enough that you couldn't bypass it, you know, it was over the road and you had to cross it. So it was probably something which would be about 8 to 10 foot deep. And which was enough to hold it up, and so we got a bailey bridge there, would have taken a long, long time. So it was a matter of as much brickwork and rubble and stuff that you could throw in just to make it smooth enough to get over.
Have you any idea of roughly how long it took to actually fill it in and get a passage across?
I think the best part of 6 hours, 6-7 hours, I think, something like that.
Who actually organised the civilians to do the labouring for you? Who went off and
called them up? People that were in the houses all around, and you just went to them and. I think I organised the people to come in my pigeon Italian, and they've been quite happy to come and help. Anything that they could throw in, they threw in.
I mean, did you do that through the local mayor, or did you just collar people at random?
People, you know, and they went and got other people. You know, sort of saying, the enemy were. And we wanted to chase them off further, and they were only too pleased to come and to do something, because they had no love for the enemy. I think they'd all been given a pretty rough time anyway. So they were only too pleased to see us and help out. But gradually we had to go very cautiously. We were going northeast in the direction of Camerino. And there were buildings blazing in the distance as we went up there. So it was occupied then by the enemy. And they in fact had torched the buildings themselves, not by gunfire or anything like that. And they'd rounded up all the civilians, whether they planned to shoot them or what. But, you know, we were a little bit concerned, apparently. And I think they might have done more to him, but until some of our armoured cars appeared. And so they then withdrew, and I think might well have saved the civilians from harm.
They left them behind?
Yes.